convinced my son is having this project week where he's supposed to be hanging out in my lab and seeing what it's like and just helping out with a project. And he's studiously avoiding coming to this talk. So I'm gonna see if I can have him roll in and listen to your talk. So give me a second. It's just a personal issue.
I think we need to roll in a chair too.
Yeah, we'll roll in a chair. First roll in a chair.
Alex is probably gonna say.
Alex.
Hey, John,
dude. Okay. If not, this chair is technically still available.
Yeah, she does have more chairs. Just bring them over.
It's good, it's good.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, I've got you. Okay, I appreciate it.
We're just not going to
get that wall.
Okay. So, okay, so we're recording here, and well, you should go ahead and project your slides, Patrick.
Yep.
And you can turn around to the camera and say hello.
Yeah.
The camera's right behind you. Hello, hello, hello. For anybody who might be remote, I think that we have Yuxu remote. So welcome to Patrick, second year PhD student. Who I know that, you know, so I'm not sure what work you're going to talk about, but, you know, you have this very interesting work that's sort of skeptical, you know, quantification of whether SAEs are getting interesting things or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that might be what you're talking about today. Is that right?
It is. It's definitely the first part. What I'm talking about.
Excellent. Excellent. So we're looking forward to it. I think some interesting insights here. And so take it away, Patrick.
I think if I maximize this, it's going to vanish from the screen. So I might.
Oh, wait, will it really?
Yeah. Okay.
And what happened?
Oh, no. Wait. Oh, amazing. Okay. That was great. Okay. So I guess the overarching theme of my work has been finding the units of analysis for mechanistic interpretability. And I guess quickly, I mean, you all know what MacInterp is, so I might just get the slide. But basically, how do you figure out what LLMs are doing internally? And one of the key problems of this is finding the proper units of interpretability to use for this. So originally people were looking at neurons, which turned out to be quite coarse and polysemantic. And we had the same problem with heads, language models. And they seem like quite complex objects to actually interpret. And one of the reasons for this is that superposition may lead to polysemanticity, where your neurons represent multiple unrelated concepts. And sparse autoencoders were proposed as a way of kind of undoing that superposition, potentially undoing the polysemanticity of activations. I went through that pretty quickly. So,
anybody want to discuss that before we go on? This whole agenda?
The sparse autoencoder.
Yeah, the polysemantic hypothesis, the hypothesis that sparse autoencoders might be a way of reversing this. We can discuss it in more detail, yeah.
So sparse autoencoders is from dictionary learning. And dictionary learning is like, oh, let's try to get signals from some... Let's decompose inputs that we have. Sparse autoencoders is like one specific approach.
Yep.
We often have like linear encoders and decoders. What do you think of the linear representation hypothesis? Are really linear representations the things that we expect in these models?
Yeah, I guess that transformers are like kind of linear. Seems pretty plausible that all, I guess, representations are structured in a linear manner, and linearity is the best like way of interpreting those structures is less clear to me. Like you can clearly build nonlinear structure in the activations of language models, given that this has been observed. So it's possible that like SAEs are not the best way of interpreting this kind of activation space. Does that make sense?
So maybe based on like experiments, we found many directions that makes sense, that are semantically meaningful.
In SAEs or like
language models in general?
Yeah, yeah. So there seems to be like semantically meaningful nonlinear structure in language models. But then there's also like obviously linear stuff too. So one example would be like Llama seems to use helices to do arithmetic, which is like a nonlinear structure, but then other things are like included as binary variables, which I think makes sense to model as a linear feature.
Do we think that sparsity loss is a good enough proxy for interpretability?
No, it seems pretty bad, doesn't it? I think it looks like it kind of works for some things and is really cheap. So,
also, like for the people who have worked with SAEs, how many of the features are like a percentage? How many of the features are actually interpretable? And most of them are like a little bit noisy or very noisy.
Interpretable how? I think
like you pass some activation and you see that it has like one mode in the design.
Yeah. And I'd say like most of them look pretty good when you just eyeball them on activations. I think Chan probably can say more about this in the SAE bench results. And most of them look pretty good most of the time.
We have one benchmark, which is like automated interpretability, and then we take like a subset. SAEs have like a width of like maybe 64K.
Yeah.
You want to have like at least like 5 to 10x from your dense model activation space. And then we just like take a representative sample of like 1,000 features.
And you apply
out of these, there's like 70% that we get at least some interpretability signal when asking Claude Haiku, is this some concept?
70% is actually pretty good. I was expecting a much lesser number.
But he's not talking about interventions now.
Yeah, I know it's the
good correlation, but, right?
Yes.
Well, okay. So that's Mike. I had like we had a SAE project and we did it on Stable Diffusion Turbo. So I think we could take the time to do it a bit more slowly because nobody did anything like that there. And like we observed, if we have just a large number of SAE features, they still are interpretable. Like they latch on to interpretable things, but we cannot like turn the ball feature on or off to get a picture of a ball. But when we reduce the expansion factor to like two, like from we started with language model settings where they use 64. When we chose two, then we suddenly could turn on and off a ball feature and it would do something.
So when you have very coarse features, then more.
I guess it's a trade-off basically. If you have like many features, you obviously get feature splitting and you cannot do anything about it. And then maybe they are not causally affecting the forward pass anymore as you would expect it. Yeah. I think like, so for me, the surprising thing is like I did a PhD in like basically computing sparse representations with respect to fixed basis changes. So in the SAE, this is kind of learned. And my impression was like, these methods are really bad. like dictionary learning is really, really bad. And so it's kind of surprising that like for this use case, it seems to be fine.
Does it seem to be fine? It's definitely not fine, right?
I think sparsity is more like a wishful thinking than anything else. It's just one simple simplifying assumption that we actually can implement. That doesn't mean that this is how networks represent things.
Yeah.
But it's just important to keep in mind. What did I want?
Absolutely.
Wanted something, yes, but actually wanted to make a different point, but it will come later.
Okay.
Great. One question I had, it's a naive question. Is the idea of like superposition is like you have like orthogonality kind of like approximate.
Oh, this is great. Why don't we because we have a mixed audience, right? So we have some people who've done a bunch of published work in SAEs. And then we have some people who are visitors who have not done any interpretability research at all. Can you go back and just explain what is this superposition business at all?
Yeah. So superposition is basically when you have sparsely activating features You can compress more features into fewer dimensions, basically. So you have like five features that are sparsely active and represent them using two neurons in a like single hidden layer in autoencoder.
So yeah, my question with that was if it's it's sort of like you have a vector which has multi directions, like it's like a sum of directions in a sense, like the angles shift as little subcomponents nudge it. Is an SAE sort of like decomposed direction, or is that a poor abstraction to think about it as? Like giving principal directions for subcomponents of the representation that is being blown up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's how I think about it.
So I haven't seen, like, so this toy models of superposition blog, is there a paper that explicitly applies as some kind of sparse autoencoder on this toy setting to explicitly reverse it? There's somebody probably, like,
there's a whole tutorial on Arena that walks you through this.
They do
some serious intuition building and amazing work in teaching this stuff.
So I guess my technical question is, you know, the setup that everybody uses with this sparsity loss, like, does it work well in this toy setting? Does it recover the does it recover the hidden latents that, you know, that happen? Does it actually work in that case?
Yeah. I don't know if it works every time, but
I think like two things that are really good about the SAE or the superposition story are, like, first, like this combinatorial argument with there are simply more features in the world than coordinates in your D-model vector, like in your intermediate states. So certainly a single component cannot correspond to a single feature. But that is a good argument. And then the other argument that why I think linearity makes sense in transformers is that, like, how you compute keys, queries, values is all linear. So you keep having this linear bottlenecks in your computation. So if you want to get good keys, queries, values, it's better, this stuff needs to be read out linearly, right? At this, from the perspective of the attention layer. I think that should somehow promote linearity. This is also more like a wishy-washy
intuition.
Yeah.
Does that sort of align with your intuition, Michael? Or is there a different question that you had about this?
It's like when I think about a vector and I think about, like, directions could be subsets of it could be a subspace that has a direction. And when you blow it up into a very large vector space and you have a now subspace of that large vector space, which has a more, like, broken apart direction, it feels unclear to me how that could then be tied back to the original smaller vector, which is probably where my mental model is incorrect with it. So I imagine the smaller case, the superposition part is, like, things are imposed on each other in a way that you can't actually, like, piece them apart, and then in the large dimension space you're probably primarily working from there. But I was wondering if there was, like, a back chaining thing you could do from the large dimension space to modify the low dimension space in a meaningful way.
I don't really understand.
What do you mean?
So is what you're just discussing, like, in contradiction to this idea that you might have three independent features that you're trying to encode in two dimensions?
It's not a contradiction.
I see.
I guess it's like, can you modify new? Okay, no. I think I need to think on this a bit more. Yeah, I think it makes sense in that regards. Yeah. Can you remove then if there's two, say there's two features in a low dimension space, or three in two dimensions, let's say, could you smush it down, reduce it to the two principal ones, and get rid of the third?
I suppose it depends on the sparsity. At a certain level of sparsity, you could.
But it's counterintuitive. So if there is no sparsity and these are three dense features,
then the optimal solution is to do the PCA solution and keep the most significant ones, because you only have two dimensions you can represent. And you have capacity to do two independent things, and that's what you're going to do. So the counterintuitive thing is, if you have really high sparsity, like these three things are all really rare, right? Then it's the wrong solution to throw away the rarest one, right? The right solution is to overload the rarest one, you know, in this vector space, because it's really unlikely that what you have two of these things at the same time. And so if you see the overloaded direction, then it's much more likely that it's that third thing than it is like some bizarre coincidence of the two unlikely things. So like that's like, it turns out that's like the efficient encoding. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, huh?
Absolutely. Great example.
Professional teacher, right? Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, that like, do people think about like using SAEs to learn about co-occurrence of data or something like that? Like these things would like never appear together, so we should impose them on each other or something like that.
I don't know if you think about this.
Okay, cool.
Cool. Should I?
Okay. Yeah, it's gone.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so SAEs apply to LLMs, seemingly give you these nice interpretable features. For example, this one activates on DNA sequences, and the more it looks like DNA sequence, the more strongly this SAE feature activates. There's a typo in that third bullet point, it should say nice and modest semantic, but it seems like it responds to like one kind of human legible feature of the data. Now, whether you can like steer on that or probe on that or whatever, it's a different question, but now they just look good. And then one thing that seems to happen as you increase the size of the sparse autoencoder is that your more coarse features in smaller sparse autoencoders split into more features in larger ones. So you probably can't read this, but basically this is like a high level feature that responds to mathematical notation in the text in a small SAE, and then in larger SAEs, this seems to split into multiple features that respond in subsets of mathematical notation in text, so subfeatures of mathematical notation. And then this one is like the in mathematical prose that splits into like more specific uses of the in maths related text.
Was this like just manually like found and like you made it in this hierarchical, or like how was this splitting feature found? Like,
so these were found using co-activation of features in the two SAEs.
This was found using the
co-activation.
Co-activation. By how frequently they co-activate.
Okay, so could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so two features like these two top two features, if this one activating implies that this one activates, then it's likely that it's a subfeature of the parent feature.
So you have like three columns, right?
Yep.
And these are sparse autoencoders with different expansion factors.
Yes.
So the one with the small expansion factor has, we only look at two features. And now we go like one expansion factor up. And so for these two features that you learned previously, now you learn like, I don't know, seven.
Oh, shoot. Did I record?
Yeah, it's recorded.
I'm recording. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay.
That doesn't make sense.
I always forget.
So you look for this feature.
Very nice.
And with the higher dimensions, instead of finding like just two features, you find like eight or seven or whatever features there is.
Yeah. So when this feature is active, some of these features will be active in the larger model, and when one of these features is active, this one will be active in the smaller model. That makes sense.
I was just going to ask how you control for the locality, because like, I mean, in these contexts you see it flare out very specifically, but it's possible that there's another superposition where the machine learning also shows up in syntactic biology or something. I guess, is there any like methods for like probing in the external neighborhood of the what's hypothesized to be, to just verify that it doesn't go out? Or really, more, how do you actually like determine, oh, it's very specifically this the versus that the versus, yeah.
So choosing automata or human interp, so collecting new examples in which it activates, then coming up with a thesis of what the feature represents.
Nice.
Yeah. Any more questions on the trip? The first thing we kind of wanted to evaluate was the hope was initially with SAEs, and I think Professor Ola went quite hard on this, was that like SAEs find the features that you exactly need to do all mechanistic interpretability work, and the like a canonical atomic set of features. So we wanted to look at this more because obviously you have feature splitting, which kind of like is evidence against this idea that at different dictionary sizes you get different types of feature, different granularities of feature. And so we just started by looking at what happens when you scale the dictionary of your sparse autoencoder. So you train like 10 different SAEs of different expansion factors. And we had a theory that these feature splits happened so you could decrease the L0. These are ReLU SAEs that have sparsity loss as opposed to top K SAEs. So when you split your features, you get features that are less frequently active and respond to more specific features. So you don't need, like, if you want to do something niche, like one of these in the smallest SAE, you might need two features to represent that single feature. In the larger SAE, whereas in this one, you only need a single feature. So your sparsity, you have a higher sparsity in the larger SAE for this feature. And then alongside that, you seem to get new features in larger sparse autoencoders. So for example, in this one, as you scale the SAE, you start seeing latents or features that respond to specific elements of the periodic table in the text. So in a small SAE, you might get like oxygen and nitrogen being very common. As you scale the sparse autoencoder, you get a feature that responds strictly to plutonium, something a bit more rare. And how we started looking at this was using what we called SAE stitching, which is where you switch features between SAEs of different sizes. So what that would mean is, for example, if you switch all of these features for that feature, what happens to the L0 and sparsity and the reconstruction performance of the sparse autoencoder? Does it go up? Does it go down? So we thought that when you take split features from a larger SAE, so one of the right-hand columns of this diagram, and replace a unsplit feature in a smaller SAE, this would not affect the MSE because they're strictly reducing the L0 loss, and it would reduce the L0 of the small model. So this small model is now like small model minus one latent from the small model, one feature from the small model, plus five features from the bigger model that have just been inserted in place of that one feature. And then on the flip side, if you add what we're calling novel features, which are not present in the smaller SE, if you add a novel feature from the large SE to the smaller SE, your MSE goes down, but your L0 isn't affected, or maybe goes up a little bit. So that makes sense what we're testing here.
So yeah. When you say switching, which way do you mean? Do you mean reducing? So when you you say it doesn't affect the MSE, but reduces L0. Is that from moving the split features into the unsplit ones, or they're moving the unsplit ones to replace the split? Which one? Which direction is it?
It's replacing this feature in the small SE, so a feature in the small SE with features from a bigger SE.
I see. So that doesn't hurt MSE, and then it helps L0.
This is currently just a hypothesis.
Oh, that's your hypothesis. Oh, I'm sorry. So, not something I should memorize. It's what you're guessing.
It's what we're guessing, and. Okay.
Just because I'm not super familiar, MSE is the difference between the activations before and after the sparse autoencoder, and then L0 is the sparsity, basically, like how the norm of the natural sparse part.
Exactly. So the other and all these possible part, and then the reconstruction performance.
I see. So when you say it doesn't affect MSE, you're saying doesn't change the activations, and then reduces L0 or increases is based on whether you're adding more features or removing features from the sparse part of it. Or zero
you use sparse code for a specific activation. Yeah, yeah.
So like, so the fact that you're switching it, okay, not sure. So you're adding like, you're switching the from like the ones that are more like broken up, like mm-hmm. bigger essays into the smaller one.
Yep.
What's the intuition behind that? Like, is it like so maybe because of the diagram, I assume that like the smaller essays still have those capabilities that the bigger essays have. It's just that there's just more like separate features that you can define in bigger ones.
Yeah, so the small ones could have the capabilities, but they might require multiple latents to reconstruct the activation, whereas the big ones might be able to reconstruct it with fewer latents. So I'm using features and latents interchangeably. Features are like, I guess, features of the data, and then latents are like the actual learned features of the SAE in the literature.
And to Michael's question, sorry, L0 is specifically the number of SAE latents that are active or like that are non-zero when doing a specific reconstruction. So it's not the number of all latents that we have in the set. Not sure if that was.
Oh, so it's actually a little.
When you run them,
it's an index.
I'm sorry?
Is it like a literally just a count of how many non-sparse?
Absolutely.
How many are active? It has so, the sparse code.
Like literally, or
in practice, you take practice. Web text and try to 100 tokens, put it in your sparse autoencoder map back down, and count the number of non-zero SAE latents.
Oh, that L0. I was thinking it was L1 for some reason the whole time. Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So right. L1's used for the regularization, right. But then we actually look at the L0 because that's what we really care about for sparse coding.
Cool. Just a quick question. So when you say novel feature from the large SE to the small SE. Could you give an example?
Yeah, so that'd be like, I don't know, the blue thing. I can't read these things, but one of the rare elements being represented in large SAE, like, I don't know, uranium.
Oh, you mean large SAE means, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
More number of latents.
Sorry, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, a bigger dictionary yeah. size is what I mean by a larger SAE. Cool. So yeah, we started looking at this like swapping setup, and basically, yeah. Okay, so on the plot here is inserting latents from a larger SAE into a smaller SAE, and this is basically testing whether they're novel or they're not novel. So if they're novel, we say that the reconstruction is improved because they add information that is not reconstructed by the smaller SAE. If they are novel, we say that, sorry, if they aren't novel, we say that the MSE goes up because they're duplicating information already contained in the small SAE. And that means it's just like it worsens the reconstruction because it over reconstructs like one direction.
Why would it worsen the MSE? It could also be like, oh, I put a redundant feature there.
Yeah, so because they're linearly active, they activate linearly. So if you have something that's like in your small SAE, you have a feature for mammal, and then in your larger SAE, you have a feature for cat. Then you add the cat feature into the smaller SAE, you have a mammal feature and you have a cat feature that both fire when they see a cat. So it kind of like adds it twice.
Okay.
If that makes sense. This possibly wouldn't be an issue with top K SAEs. But is an issue with value essays.
How do you select for novelty?
So it's literally whether it increases or decreases the reconstruction performance.
So this is a very creative chart. I wonder if you take a minute here to explain the X and the Y axis to me.
Yeah. So on this chart, so basically the issue we had was that combinatorially swapping and evaluating all possible swaps is really expensive. So we wanted to use cosine similarity to evaluate whether latents are novel or what we call reconstruction latents. So the y-axis is the effect on the reconstruction when you add a latent from a large SAE into a small SAE.
So each point here corresponds to
a large SAE latent.
Oh, just one large SAE latent.
Yeah.
No, but you're swapping it with a small.
So there's no swaps going out. Oh, there's no swaps. This is straight insertions.
Oh, it's just straight insertions.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Just inserting a large SAE latent into a small SAE.
Yes.
Got it.
And then the x-axis is cosine similarity, the maximum cosine similarity between that latent and any latent in the smaller SAE, and that's so, decoder cosine similarity.
I see. So moving to the right is a measure of more redundancy. Every point that's way to the right means that I've just inserted a large feature that's very similar to a feature that was already present in the small thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And then moving to the left means, oh, this is something that is very dissimilar to everything.
Yes.
Got it.
And there's like some sort of relationship between these two metrics. It's not absolutely perfect, obviously. But
yeah. And so there's this, so there's a reasonable question. So like, I guess you're not retraining or retuning the SAE, that's why MSE can get worse.
Yes.
So in principle, if you like increase the size of the SAE and you rebalance it, then MSE should never increase.
Exactly.
Right. But here you're not retuning.
Yeah.
I see. Have you done this graph with an actual retuning?
We have not done it with retuning. I think, like you say, we'll just prove the
results. Okay, cool.
I guess if you retune having inserted this latent here that's like very similar, then it would just like be moved to somewhere where it's similar.
Moved down,
Yeah.
Would you choose where to put the feature if you're swap the feature in, like literally in the vector? Like, is it just where the old one was? Are they the same dimensionality or?
Yeah, so the decoder vectors, all the features are the same size. So it doesn't matter where you put them.
Doesn't matter, so I could literally like randomly choose it and it wouldn't affect performance at all.
Yeah, it was just dependent to the end. You can shuffle the rows and decode and encode it.
Oh, okay.
Without affecting performance essays. Yeah, so the point of this was that basically you can relate the code sense similarity to the effect of on the reconstruction of adding in a latent from a large SAE into a small SAE. And we arbitrarily chose 0.7, just like here, as our threshold for do we think it's going to increase or decrease the reconstruction performance of a small SAE when we add a new latent in. Obviously, that's not perfect, but it's what we went with. You can move it like 0.1 in either direction, so we're getting some results. So what we looked at then was like not just inserting the novel features here, but also swapping the reconstruction features or the split features. So what I mean by that is like you have a parent in your small SAE, and then you say all of these features are children of that parent feature. So you construct a subgraph that includes this feature and those, and then you just swap it. So in this case, between these two SAEs, you construct a subgraph that includes this one, and all of these. And then the swap would be you remove these two features from the small SAE and insert all of these features from the large SAE. And what we see in this plot is that we first add the novel features. So the ones that lie below this line, well, less than 0.7, but all of these green ones in the bottom left here. We first add those in to the smaller SAE, and we see that MSE goes down, and L0 goes up, which is kind of what we predicted before. And then when you add the split features, those subgraphs of latents, the L0 goes down, which is great because it's what we predicted, but the MSE also goes down, which is not actually what we predicted. Does this plot make sense? The different colors are different sizes of sparse autoencoder encoder. So we start from a 1x expansion factor, and then add all of the novel latents from a 2x expansion factor SAE, add those into the 1x expansion factor, then do all the swaps, and that gives us the 2x expansion factor SAE. And we do that between the 2x and the 4x, between the 4x and the 8x. So like roughly interpolating between the SAEs, using this like ordered approach to swapping the novel latents and then the reconstruction latents or the split latents.
So
Doesn't it make sense that the MSE will go down for the split as well? I mean, because now you just have more information to reconstruct that same information in the capture. Like, what was the intention when you said that the MSE will not go down?
Yeah, so the intuition was that, say you have something that's like this feature plus this feature,
yeah.
like a cat that is ginger.
Yeah.
And in the small SA, it can represent that by saying cat feature active, ginger feature active. It can reconstruct it, but it uses two latents to reconstruct.
Yeah.
Whereas in the larger SAE, you might have a ginger cat feature.
Yeah.
So you get a single latent that can reconstruct it, but only uses one active latent to do the reconstruction. So both of the SAEs can represent the same thing, which is ginger cats, but they use different numbers of latents to reconstruct it. So that was our thinking initially, that like maybe larger SAEs are basically just doing like this feature plus this feature equals a new feature, and L0 goes down, but they can still represent the same information by interpolating those features.
You are assuming feature absorption in the larger SAEs.
So yeah.
You are assuming feature absorption in the larger SAE latents, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, as this plot shows, the MSE also goes down when you do the swaps, which I guess like we kind of knew probably would happen. But kind of like also disproves that the large SAE is just doing this perfect intersection between features in the small SAE. Are there any questions about any of this? This is like half of this paper.
Sorry, so the adding novel step is you're not removing the small SA features, you're just adding the bunch of split ones.
Exactly.
And no, then
sorry.
The split new, ones, the new ones.
New
the,
ones.
The unrelated ones.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, right, microsoft similarity. Okay, so then what's adding split?
So splitting is where we're like, well, sorry, this is badly written. This is like swapping. So when you
so you replace the small ones with
all SAE features with all of the related features in the big
SAE. So it's like let's add the new ones that you didn't have the information about, and then we'll also remove the ones that are more coarse and just replace them with okay.
More specific.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
So on the other side, like you could also just like take the larger SAE because you're like taking the new SAE features from the larger, and you're also replacing SAE features contained in the larger and in the small. So in the end, you kind of like take the larger SAE.
Yeah,
only exactly. Put the new features from the smaller SAE.
Yeah, every time the line changes color,
yeah.
That's when you've arrived at an identical SAE to the larger SAE.
Ah.
So at this point, this is just the 2x expansion factor SAE.
Okay, thanks.
So kind of looking more into this idea that larger SAEs are doing like feature A plus feature B is the split feature. We figured that we might be able to like undo this process. So linearly decompose the large SAE features into meta features. So features that like form parts of multiple features in the large SAE. So an example of this is like a small SAE might have features for shape and features for color. And then these get composed into like colored shapes in the large SAE, which I guess is similar to the ginger cat example. And what we came up with was meta SAEs, which is where you take an SAE's decoder, and then you train another SAE on that decoder. So instead of using activations as the training data, you're using the decoder of another SAE as your training data. And the idea here is that like if SAEs can recover features from activation data, then they can probably also recover meta features from features, if that makes sense.
So what's the input to this?
So it's the decoder of another SAE.
But like the decoder is a matrix of vectors, right?
Yeah.
So
those are activations.
So the activations that get multiplied with this matrix.
No, no. So the standard SAE is trained on like all the activations of your data set.
Right.
Or a model at a certain point.
Yeah.
And then you learn a decoder, an SAE decoder based on these activations. And then you basically apply the same process, but you instead of using the activation data set, you're using just the decoder of another SAE.
But the decoder is a fixed matrix.
Those are activations on a data set.
Decoded.
Decoder.
I mean like the output of the encoder when you feed through the
activation. No, I mean like the fixed decoder matrix.
What do you do with the fixed decoder matrix?
You train as fast as you can, right?
On each row or by hitting the...
On the entire thing.
Yeah, on each row.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So each row is like an example.
I see. Okay.
A training example for the match SE.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'm sorry. I still didn't get
it. Kind of a small data set.
Isn't this kind of like a small data set? If you like literally put on the rows or do you like also train on activations that are... like activating those rows.
It's pretty small data set.
So okay. Just to make it clear that we get it right, like if you have an expansion factor of 2, then the data set size for the meta SAE is 2 times the model.
Yeah, it's like 1500.
Okay.
So we did this on knowledge ones. We normally use like 32x, 64x expansion patches. But I mean, it seems to train pretty well on small amounts of data.
So SAEs are one way to decompose input data.
Mm-hmm.
You could do SVD or PCA. Why did you choose like do the SAE training again instead of?
Yeah, because you had this hypothesis that'd be like large SAEs are doing like feature addition on the decoder directions of smaller SAEs. So it's doing like A times feature.
I didn't get that.
So it's doing like adding the large SAE decoder directions would be like linear sums of small SAE decoder directions.
Yeah.
So like this feature times x plus this feature times y equals the new the feature in the larger SAE. And also just empirically, PCA directions or decoder or SAEs didn't give us anything interesting in the same way that PCA.
It's like you don't assume them to be orthogonal. PCA gives you orthogonal directions. You don't really want to have
you don't want orthogonal directions. Yeah. In the same way that PCA on model activations also doesn't give you intelligible features. Whereas SAEs maybe do more. So yeah, applying a metro SAE to the decoder of a big SAE, we looked at an Einstein feature, the larger SAE, which seems to activate on Einstein things. And the meta latents responded to... This is going to be quite complex to explain. The meta latents responded to latents in the large SAE that responded to things that started with E, if that makes sense. So in this feature, responds to like latents corresponding to Einstein and to Estonia and to Eagles and to education and to the name Eleanor. So if that makes sense.
Where does the Einstein latent live?
So this lives in the large SAE that we're decomposing.
Okay.
And then the green ones also live in the large SAE that we're decomposing. And then the blue ones are these meta latents that we're looking at.
Where do they live? That's also in the large SAE.
So the meta latents are in the decoder of the meta SAE, which is the SAE that we trained on the decoder weights of the larger SAE. So there's like two tiers of SAE. You've got like your activations, then you've got your large SAE, then you've got your metro SAE, and they're all decomposing the one below it.
So is the hypothesis here that there are like morphemes almost? Like and as you break things apart, you reach like the bottom of the decomposition? Or because when I look at this, I'm abstracted from the actual like setup, but it feels like there would be cycles. Like you get to starts with E, you get Eagle, you just keep going off far away from Einstein and maybe branch back somewhere. So is it just, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess this is a bit confusing diagram in that Einstein is in the same set of things that all of the green ones are. So it's kind of like the wrong way around in that all of these belong to that, but this doesn't, like, this only connects to that through Einstein. So yes, you could get cycles.
And the breakup is more semantic rather than like syntactic or anything like that. Like, it's, these things are like, well, I guess starts with E is a syntax thing.
Yeah.
But like Germany is semantically similar to Einstein, but it's not like syntactically similar. There's not like a structure of the pieces of the letters in Einstein.
Yeah. So it does both. I'm not sure there's like a meaningful difference between semantic features and syntactic features. They just seem to be like features.
Is this a real example?
Yeah.
It looks pretty good. It would increase the font size though.
I can't zoom. I apologize. this is all screenshotted from the paper. I put this together like yesterday.
This looks nice.
Also, like, what layer is this? Like, is that a pretty late layer?
This is layer 8 of GPT-2, which is 12 layers. GPT-2 is small. So, like, somewhere in the middle-ish. So, what we found is that you basically, by doing training mesh SEs, you get the same thing as smaller SEs. So, when you compare a small SE of, like, expansion factor 2, to a metro SE of expansion factor 2 that's been trained on like an expansion factor 32 SAE, you get very similar latents. And you can also just do the same thing that metro SEs do by feeding in the decoder of a large SAE into a smaller SAE. And you get the same, by the way, activations of clustering. So I think this is like some kind of evidence to the fact that larger SEs seem to like some composition of small SE features, and you can also decompose them. And I think, like, what all of this means is that SEs don't give you these nice atomic canonical features out of the box. Like, you get feature splitting, which means that as you scale your SE, you get more and more narrow features, so it can be like hard to find the right level to steer on or to probe. But also, you get new features that aren't included in smaller SEs, so your MSE goes up. So yeah, basically, we're arguing that if you just like scale the SAE infinitely, you don't end up with the optimum set of units for any intelligibility block.
Why didn't people want orthogonality in the decoder basis? It seems like
because then you only can have D model.
Sorry, what?
There are only D model orthogonal.
I mean, it'll, yes, but in principle, if you add some sort of orthogonality loss, it's not like it's gonna like override all of the other losses.
Mm. You could have near orthogonal, and then you can fit D squared in, no problem.
Yeah,
I see.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it can kind of like encourage that these features are as far as possible, and then it will solve the feature splitting problem. Maybe. And then it will encourage finding new features.
Is that what LLMs do?
So what?
Is that what LLMs do? Do they encode features as like nearly orthogonal?
We don't know.
We don't know. Yeah, I feel like this is a major assumption.
Is it, well, that's what the superposition hypothesis is suggesting, right?
No, that's just the three blue, one brown video explaining how great it is to get rid of orthogonality.
Okay, even if you have only two dimensions, but you want to squeeze in five features, you kind of want those five features to be as far from each other as possible.
Right. Yeah.
And if you use the orthogonality laws, maybe I'm not assuming that you'll kind of like find something that is completely orthogonal, but it will probably encourage the decoder vectors to be more diverse from each other, or maybe capture new features.
So, and then how do you choose the features you want?
How do you choose the features?
Yeah, so you
can't do that with SAEs as well.
Are you just proposing a loss term encouraging orthogonal, like, yes,
Yes.
Approximate.
Yes.
Just literally something like QQT is equal to I.
Yeah.
John, someone did this at maths, right? Do you remember this?
I'm sorry?
Someone tried this at maths where they imposed an orthogonality regularizer to SE fractions. I can't remember what the outcome was.
What was that? I don't
know. No, I can't remember. I feel like this very much didn't work, but I can't
remember. All these SAE people. Okay, more SAE questions, because I, you know, don't do SAE work. So, you know, one of the, and I just finished teaching this in my CS7150 class. You know, autoencoders, this old ancient area of neural networks. And one of the dissatisfying things about it is there's no information theoretic, you know, basis for, you know, what you're doing. Just by changing dimension and dimensionality bottleneck. I mean, a mathematician, a pure mathematician would tell you if you have a single real number, you can encode an infinite amount of information in a single real number because you have as many digits as you want. So you know, the modern solution to it is you do what the VA people do. Like, you introduce noise and then you have, like, you know what your bit rate is, right? So like a variational autoencoder. Right, would introduce noise. I don't follow the SAE literature. Has somebody tried a fan out VAE where, you know, you're controlling the information content using, like, sort of the noise formulation that statisticians have proposed, as opposed to using like sparsity loss to reduce it? Because then you actually know the bit rate, right? Then you actually know the information that's going through, rather than just counting dimensions.
Mm.
Right.
Try something simple.
What do you say? You've tried it. Like, you've physically tried it yourself. Just great.
So
I love
it. Tried training. Our goal was to get a binary SAE with, like, not features having digital running positive weights, but just like have binary on-off activations. And the way we try to train it is like giving a probability of its active, assigning a probability.
Yeah, that's similar. Yeah, that's great.
Yes, that's pretty similar. And just out of experience, like in our experience, it didn't really work in toy settings. But this was just an experiment, and we should look into the theory of, like, why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I think,
and then there's an early, like, Anthropic note in one of the big blog posts that says, like, oh, we also tried better
VAEs. Yeah.
And it didn't really work.
Right.
But, like, there hasn't been a rigorous analysis.
Right.
To my knowledge.
Right.
But, like, how would you interpret the VAE bottleneck features?
Oh, I mean, you know, I'm not sure. Like, it's kind of like the way you'd interpret this, right? So, like, in typical VAEs, like, there's this whole community around beta VAEs, right, where they interpret them the same way that this community interprets SAEs. They just look at the first dimension, right? They look at the first neuron, and they're like, oh, that's pretty meaningful.
Yeah, but, like, you cannot get disentanglement from that, like, if this combinatorial argument is true. Like, in language, if you applied that to a language model, or...
Oh, well, so I don't know, like, so beta VAs disentangle. That's sort of one of the arguments of beta VAs.
Yeah.
Right. But I just, that's my question is, has somebody tried to adapt it to the setting?
I chatted about this a lot with Nish, because, like, in this traditional disentanglement literature, people found kind of that it's basically impossible from unsupervised data alone. And so there is sort of a mismatch in between this impossibility result and SAEs seemingly disentangling.
Right.
It's a good direction.
Seems like a question. Yeah. Yeah, there's old stuff, right? There's people who have been looking at it for a long time, and it's like there's a little bit of disconnect where the literature is not connected. Yeah.
The setting is slightly different, though, because, like, they didn't train on the whole internet.
Right, that's right. The beta VA people.
Yeah. They have their toy.
The
colored balls.
Yeah, the colored balls the ovals of different angles or that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might have. Anthropic says they tried it.
They mentioned this stuff in their blog posts.
Yeah.
So they at least are aware of it.
We don't know how much they.
But how maybe that's the secret sauce.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, there's more if you want more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, let's go. Can you squeeze it? Well, let's keep on going.
Okay.
Okay.
So basically after this project, I was kind of like dissatisfied with what's possible between coders were learning. It seemed like these decoder directions weren't like the nice units that we thought they would be. Kind of inspired by relative representation metrics, and kind of inspired by some notes GDM had on applying orthogonal matching pursuit to the decoder matrices of SAEs, I started looking at whether you could basically just take activations and use inference time optimization to deconstruct activations into a set of anchor activations, if that kind of makes sense. Basically the hope here was that instead of having these messy dictionaries that you get around sparse filter encoders that don't transfer between models, you would have this not so messy collection of activations that you can transfer between models. You can evaluate, you do like potentially model dipping, this kind of stuff with it. And then you're just using inference time optimization to do a decomposition rather than learning your encoder. So,
I think I asked this question in past meetings, but I guess I don't really have answer for it yet. So whenever I hear model dipping, the first thing I hear think about is cross-coder.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so similar? Like, what's up right now? Yes. Like, doing?
Yeah, so I guess both this and cross-coding are decomposing model activations into a fixed set of vectors.
So any particular difference?
Yes. So cross-coders learn encoders and decoders for four different models that you're analyzing. And then they regularize on like the same data point, the same latent should be active in the sparse code. Whereas in this, I'll explain more in a moment, but basically you iteratively construct a set of anchor points on two different models, and then you just dip. Satisfying models directly. So they're pretty different approaches in that there's an optimization, current time optimization.
But a very naive and simple way, just train an SAE on the smaller batch that you get.
So again.
Would a very intuitive and maybe boring way be like train an SAE on the small incoming batch that you optimize your pursuit on, or is it like a...
So like inference time training SAEs.
Mm-hmm. Would that fit in your matching pursuit framework, or is that a different idea?
Yeah, I mean, you could do that. You wouldn't train the decoder then. I think you'd optimize the sparse code. Right.
Is the whole decoder frozen?
Okay? In this, yes. It's just a collection of activations.
Okay.
This is this thing where you have a fixed matrix and you're like, oh, I have this magical matrix, and on the other side things are sparse. If I just cross my fingers. And now the matching pursuit computes these non-zero values on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So basically what this method does, very naively, it starts with an empty dictionary and you try to deconstruct incoming activations into this dictionary. You set a threshold, and if the reconstruction loss exceeds the threshold, you just add that activation to your dictionary, and then you continue. So you iteratively build up your dictionary like this, and then you can stop when it reaches the specified size or not. And the idea here is just like it's a very naive way of building something that behaves somewhat like a sparse filter encoder without actually doing all the training, which is like a major issue with sparse filter encoders, is that they often have more parameters than the LLM they're decomposing the activations for, which seems like pretty inefficient for intelligibility.
But you've got to get the decoder directions in the first place, and that's It requires a lot of training.
First of all, soldier encoders.
Oh, he just collected them by just,
they're just
sticking them into a matrix.
Here you're just getting them greedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just say, take the first one.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Is it
actually,
good
that's a great idea.
One? And then the answer is, no, not good enough. Take the second one.
Yeah. And then the third one. Is good enough for the third one?
Yeah, maybe it's good enough. It's a linear combination of the first two. Drop it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no optimization of the decoder. And this kind of works sometimes for some, in terms of reconstruction, works in some models okay. Like on 5370M, seems to do okay. Does a bit worse on 160, and then is terrible on Gemma 22B. And then interpretability results are mixed. So the auto interp is like kind of okay-ish, whereas linear programming is pretty dreadful. But the advantage to this approach is that you can train on 0.2% of the data that you do for SAEs, roughly the same performance, to the max performance. So for example, I trained these hitters, I'm calling them, on Llama 405B for all layers in like one night on a single 4090, which I think would be quite hard to do for SAEs. And then this is kind of like propped off, but you need like 100 million tokens before SAEs achieve the same reconstruction performance as it does achieve with 1 million tokens.
So obviously a greedy approach is going to depend on the order of your presentation of your data.
Yep.
So now SAEs are also unstable. You retrain them, you get a different SAE, right? So like how does stability compare between your greedy approach and SAEs? How much?
In terms of reconstruction performance or in terms of like...
No, just like well, I'm just curious. I don't know how you quantify stability of SAE latents, like how different, you know, it tends to be if you train it twice. But also for you always, like how would you, like how do people quantify, you know, stability of these two things?
Do people quantify stability of SAEs? I'm not sure.
I don't know. They should, right? Right, because you know, there's sort of like, should I trust an SAE? Well, I guess it depends on whether if I trained it again randomly, if it gave me the same thing, or if I'm just getting random stuff out.
No, SAE is very susceptible to initialization.
I see.
I think you tend to get like a core set of features that you produce across runs, and then the less frequent iterations will tend to vary.
Has that been quantified?
So the main output parameter for SAEs are the sparsity penalty, and the resulting sparsity, and the only thing that I can say is like in comparison to changing the sparsity of the SAE, the stability is much smaller. So if we have a plot of sparsity on the x-axis and the reconstruction performance on the y-axis, then change over sparsity induces a much bigger change than like the error that you would plot for like retraining SAEs with the same sparsity. And yeah, so I guess a meaningful metric would be like, is a change in just like retraining on a different random seed much bigger than a change when varying the sparsity? And from the SAE bench results, SAEs are pretty robust when compared to the sparsity scale, or those changes in sparsity.
There's a paper that looks like they do it across training runs and only 30% of the features are shared across different seeds.
Which paper is this recent?
This is from the Luther AI people. January 2025, yeah.
This is great. Do you have a paper?
Soon.
Do you have an archive? Or?
I have a... it's still a bit of a work in progress.
Well, thanks for sharing.
Do you have a GitHub repo?
Yeah, nice. I have nothing yet, but there will be all of these things hopefully by the end of the month.
So I missed how you initialize the vectors you're choosing in your pursuit, matching pursuit.
Yeah, so it's
random in it.
So you start with an empty dictionary, and then you basically say, for each incoming activation, can we decompose it into the vectors in the dictionary?
What's the residual?
With the residual,
yeah.
And okay. If the reconstruction error exceeds the threshold, you add it to the dictionary. There's no...
You add what? The residual vector?
No,
the whole vector.
Yeah.
The whole input to the
the whole activation.
So, yep. So yeah. I think the thing to note, like to make this really easier to digest, is like these matching pursuit algorithms. They assume that the dictionary is there already. Okay. The matching pursuit itself doesn't learn a dictionary.
Yeah. But what's so the fixed dictionary that's getting
He creates a dictionary on which he later can run matching pursuit.
So how do you make the dictionary?
You deconstruct it by iteration of the training data.
So it's like approximate Gram-Schmidt. So you know the Gram-Schmidt algorithm, right?
Yeah.
Oh. Right. And so it's like, oh yeah, can I decompose into the, you know, the rows that I already have?
Okay.
Right. Oh, I can't.
That's a great point.
Right. Instead of, oh, so now in Gram-Schmidt, you would just take the residual as the next row. Here, instead of taking the residual, you're taking the whole vector. Right.
But I think the residual is like a bit icky in terms of interpreting the.
Yeah, of course. It's just error. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas activation is kind of like bleep.
I see.
Yeah. Cool. So yeah. Then I looked at using the greedily constructed dictionaries as a measure of model similarity. So one experiment that in the CKA proposes, like, can you match layers between different seeds of the same model? So this is like five instances of GPT-2 score. They have 12 layers. Can you match the layers up using your representation similarity metric? And it turns out that the intersection over union of the greedily constructed ITDA dictionaries is like considerably outperforms other methods for doing this layer matching task, which seems like it could be pretty useful for model dipping, which I've not explored really. I don't know, like playing around with, but I kind of like exceeded.
Can you explain a bit slower how this matching works?
Okay, so you have two instances of GPT-2 small, which have 12 layers, and they're trained on different initializations or different seeds. And the question is, like, can you look at two layers of the model and basically, like, assign some metric to their similarity? You do this for all pairs of the 12 layers.
Is it fine if I imagine, like, the residual stream after some layer? Like, let's say, residual stream after layer 5?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So it could be that, or it could be, like, any other...
Or it could also be MLP output at layer 5.
So this is done on the residual stream in these experiments, but it could be anything.
Okay.
And the question is, how well can you match the layers? So how well can you say, like, model A layer 5 is model B layer 5? They're the most similar. Because the idea is that, like, each layer in the model should be most similar to the same layer in the other model.
Yeah.
And on this layer matching task, like, linear regression does really badly, CKA and SVCCA do slightly better. And then just the intersection over union, the Jacquard similarity between the greedily constructed dictionaries of these ITDAs that are trained on the different layers of these models gets like much higher.
So you are able to do the IOU here because like every row in your greedily constructed matrix, you can say, okay, this was the token blah in sequence blah.
Yeah. So the dictionary is just like pointers to tokens.
And this is how you compute the IOO.
Exactly.
Okay, that's cool. Very cool.
And then the nice thing about this is that you can do it in like a couple of hours on a single GPU versus SAEs, where it's like hundreds of hours of training, and then you've got to like match the SAE decoders. And it's even faster than just doing like linear regression or CKA on these models.
I think this is maybe a really nice method on a model diff.
Yeah, I think it's like not super exciting for interpretability. SAEs just like seems to do better, and SAEs are whack anyway. But the model diffing and for representation similarity, it seems potentially useful.
Or just have a first idea, something.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to just get a, you know, get to some intuition building on a new model, right?
Yeah. Very quick readout. Hugging Face should have it built in. Show me what the model diff is.
Absolutely. You can train it in like 2 minutes on a large model. Whereas that's easy, dozens of hours.
Yeah. Make sure I understand. You basically just feeding in data into it, and with respect to a particular, say, residual,
you have this dictionary and you're almost just finding a, you're trying to build a vector space that the vector is similar or dissimilar to all the previously collected ones, basically Grant Schmidt style. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you just have a bunch of varied vectors that serve as your sort of like basis of what it is.
Yep.
Cool. That's awesome.
Oh, and that's kind of the end, but I can keep going.
Oh, conclude. What's this? You got this all this cool pictures. What's, skip to the pictures. What's
the pictures are not my work. Don't worry. My work never looks as good as this.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is just like a toy model I'm playing with at the moment where you get this really interesting structure for like days of the week, months of the year. During addition in Llama, seems to like use helical structures. And basically, when you train SAEs on this kind of structure, where you have fewer latents than the dimensions in structure, they completely break. And I've just been like starting to look at how this can be fixed.
Nice.
So one really dumb approach I've used on this problem is just like taking the Fourier basis of the activations and training an SAE on that instead. And that seems to work pretty nicely. But I don't. Yeah.
Maybe you should. Novel. Yeah, maybe it should be done for all SAs. Maybe all SAs should be done on a Fourier basis.
Right? Right.
Yeah.
Maybe so fun.
Right, exactly. There's
it doesn't work, but
yeah.
Sure. It could do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm starting to get.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patrick.
We're back to a pre-deep learning feature engineering.
I know, right?
Wow.
Like, what the hell?
What the lost ones?
No.
Yeah. Interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's great. Oh, so who do you know who, Yixu Chan? Are you here for a visit day or have we?
She's been visiting from Brown.
Yeah. Oh, from Brown. Oh, yeah, that's right.
That, like,
okay, cool.
Like, no.
Nice to see you, Yixu.
Let's look at the
you're welcome.
Spot, I think that's.